wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick talks to Colleen Carroll about Portland's Eviction Representation for All Committee. Fran Mikkel explains why you should be wearing a mask at activist events. Joanna Brenner speaks with Kansans for Constitutional Freedom's Ashley All about organizing to defeat an amendment which could lead to laws banning abortion. And book mole Larry Bolden reviews The Taste of Ginger by Monsi Shaw. First up, the Eviction Representation for All Committee is gathering signatures for a Multnomah County ballot initiative. Bill Resnick talks to Colleen Carroll about evictions and the Portland campaign. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Colleen Carroll. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Colleen Carroll is an organizer with the Eviction Representation for All campaign. The campaign is now circulating a petition to get on the ballot. It's a proposal to create in Multnomah County a legal service for any renter facing eviction. We'll be talking about the initiative, why representation is so necessary, and later get into questions of class power, the role of lawyers, and also the role of movements in winning important things. So first, Colleen Carroll, tell us about the initiative and why it's important.
So our initiative, which is called Eviction Representation for All, is a part of a national movement, which is loosely called the Right to Counsel for Tenants movement. And it started in New York City when tenants and organizers got together and said, everybody who's facing an eviction, everybody who is at risk of losing their home, deserves to be able to fight for that home in court to the fullest of their ability. And the only way to do that with the court system that we have is to have a lawyer by your side. And that's especially true when it's not like a criminal case where both sides are going to have a lawyer. Because eviction happens in our civil system, neither side is guaranteed representation, but you can guarantee one side almost always does because they've got that law firm or that lawyer on retainer. Landlords know having a lawyer helps win cases, and so 90% and more have a lawyer. Tenants, we don't have lawyers on retainer. Most of us don't. And so when we receive an eviction notice, we are left to manage our way through that really technical process in an incredibly stressful situation. And when we do it by ourselves, we lose almost always, not because of the merits of our case, but because of the technicalities. And so tenants in New York started this. They pushed for it. It moved to San Francisco. And in San Francisco, they said, you know what? It's not just certain types of cases that need representation, like only non-payment or only, you know, what could be considered, you know, easy wins or the good cases. San Francisco said every tenant deserves a lawyer, and we are building off of that. And what I feel really strongly about our ballot measure is that it was written by tenants. The way that we thought about how we wanted to reduce evictions and reduce the harm of, like, the process of evictions only could be developed by people who are at risk of them. I'm really, you know, impressed and have been in wonderful conversations with legal aid services across the United States who are also doing this work. But, you know, kind of as you know, the way that a lawyer thinks about what's possible, a lawyer's imagination within the court system is really limited by what is already there, right? What is already legal. And tenants, the way we think about it is, how should this work? So our ballot measure not only would guarantee every tenant who has been served an eviction notice the right to and access to a lawyer for your case, there are a couple other pieces about how we built our program that really center the tenant's experience and reduce many of the harms, the financial harm, and make some of the solutions easier, including stipulated agreements that we can see through to the end. So we wrote it because it impacts us. And so our ballot measure is written by tenants, and we worked with an incredible lawyer who took our kind of plain language and, you know, made sure that it was legal and the county has accepted it. And now we're gathering signatures. And the last thing that I'll say that's important about this ballot measure is that it's fully funded and sustained funding. We're not going to have to fight with the government, with the county, every budgetary cycle. We're not at risk of it being kind of done away with or shrunk down through the budget process. We've made it paid for by a small increase in capital gains tax, less than 1%. And what that means is for people who earn money not through wages, but through assets, a tiny bit more of that money will get taxed, and that will pay for a sustained and robust program that is designed to reduce evictions and prevent the harm of eviction.
People argue when they hear about this initiative, they wonder, why does it include rich people? Some very well-to-do people who really don't care if they get evicted, they'll find another place. But why not try?
Right. Why didn't we do a means testing? So I think that there's two answers to that question for us. One is that tenants, you know, there are many, many people who rent across Multnomah County. It's a really expensive place. And so, sure, there are renters who bring home a fair amount of money. But that does not negate the fact that they are a renter and in a relationship of power with their landlord. And that landlord always has more power than them in that relationship. And so in this really important way that we fight for our housing, which is being able to navigate the legal system, we think that all tenants should have access to a lawyer who can help them fight for their case to the best of their ability. And the second reason that we made it universal, that's borne out in social science, both about right to counsel measures, but about a lot of social services in the United States, is that means testing, whether it's by your income bracket, your citizenship, any program that has a means test, a way of qualifying that requires people to bring documents or fill out a form or take their time to prove that they deserve that service, those are the folks least likely to see that application all the way through and won't then get access to the program. And so the way that we make this program accessible to the people who need it most is by saying that you don't have to prove you deserve it. All we need to know is that you are at risk of losing your home, and that's the only requirement for getting services.
You know, I think that lots of people who don't earn much are embarrassed to acknowledge it.
Sure.
They see that as another stigmatizing factor, and they do their best not to be seen that way. I mean, there's a couple others. One is that more people move involuntarily. That is, they don't want to go, but they get harassed. They lose jobs. There's no way that they can get the money to pay. Lawyers can be useful for those people as well, right?
There's no eviction case that having a lawyer isn't useful. And when it comes to these agreements, right, the threat of having an eviction on your record, which is a judgment of eviction, which means the judge says, yep, you know, you're evicted. The threat of that is the thing that motivates so many tenants' choices in court, whether or not we push it to trial, whether or not we show up. Now, most tenants don't realize that by not showing up, you automatically get that on your record. So you get the notice and you think, I'm just going to leave. If you don't show up to that court date, you get a judgment by default, and that's going to follow you on your record for years. And so having a lawyer on all cases, for one, would eliminate default, because that lawyer is going to show up for you. They're going to say, I'm here, right? And then we'll negotiate. We'll either negotiate a settlement or we'll go to trial. And you're right. The idea that the court could actually take all of these cases to trial is ludicrous. The court is designed to hear 45 first appearances and like three trials in a day, right? So they are assuming off the bat that of that 45, 42 of them are going to get resolved before they go to trial. How do they get resolved? Many of them either default and it just ends there, done, eviction on your record, off you go. Well, you know, you're already moved out. You don't find out until you go to rent your next place and somebody says, hey, you've got an eviction on your record. And you say, I moved out. And that doesn't matter. There's a judgment against you. But for the tenants who do show up, you get this opportunity to negotiate with your landlord. And this is, again, where having a lawyer is so important, because the way it works in Multnomah County is they say, hey, step outside with your landlord's lawyer for just a few minutes, 2 to 3 minutes, and then come back in and tell me what you decide. So you've been given a time pressure of minutes to negotiate against a skilled lawyer. You were outgunned, and basically I see it as a coercive move, right? Because they say, if you don't, then we'll go to trial and you'll have, you know, you risk monetary judgment, you risk all these things. So you're really motivated, coerced to do that 3-minute negotiation. But if you have a lawyer, what happens is that lawyer says, great, give me your number to the other lawyer. I'll call you and we'll negotiate this over 2 to 3 days. The difference between what you think you could win, you know, what terms of move out, you know, what terms of, hey, my washer machine hasn't worked in years, can we get that fixed? All of that can get discussed in a stipulated agreement. And you bet that two lawyers negotiating that is going to come out better for the tenant in the end.
Yeah. So tenants who are listening, even if there's been no eviction notice given, the landlord has been harassing them, they should go to what's going to be set up. If the initiative passes, they should go talk to them and get advice. You know, Colleen, I've worked as a legal services lawyer, and I have friends who were in the criminal courts and defending people, and my caseload was just huge. Their caseload was huger. They're representing people, but they don't have time for research. They don't really have time to talk to people. The lawyers get inundated in cases. Now, I don't think that's going to happen with this legal service because there'll be a lot fewer evictions. Well, there'll be a lot more harassment and really serious harassment, but a lot less cases that go to court. So how do we be sure that the lawyers don't get inundated to the extent where they can't really do the cases?
The best that we were able to do in this case is the way that we set up the funding and the way that we set up the legal services is there's two important things. One, we made sure there was enough money to hire enough lawyers to keep caseloads down. We've worked with this great consulting firm who's done a ton of work on this called Stout Financial and creating budgets that make sense, right, that are sustainable, and all the way down to the caseload. How many lawyers do you need to do these cases well? And so we budgeted that out and we matched the funding accordingly. And the other thing is we're not putting it all into one legal services, right? There's Legal Aid of Oregon, we have Oregon Law Center, but all of the lawyers and all the cases shouldn't have to go through those programs. So we've actually created a program such that nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations, and nonprofit law firms can apply for these funds. And it has to be no less than 5 in our community. We want these lawyers spread out across Multnomah County, and we don't want them all in legal aid offices. We want them in our cultural community centers where people are going already when they have that harassment, right? They go to the Community Alliance of Tenants. They go to places like Unite Oregon, culturally specific places, and say, hey, I'm having this problem. And those nonprofits will have in-house lawyers, housing lawyers, and a team of them who say, great, we're ready to take your case. Let's talk about it. They don't have to send them out to the single legal aid provider who is, you know, trying to hire and turn and burn lawyers. So one thing I'll say is we funded it correctly and we didn't use, the funding is not by the case. You're not incentivized to take more cases so that you can pay your bills. You know, as a tenant defense lawyer, it's based on a salary, right? And there's enough money for enough lawyers and paralegals. I'll shout out the Oregon State Bar here. The Oregon State Bar is taking up under consideration this year a program to make paralegals able to operate in certain civil cases, including eviction cases. And so what that will allow is a lot of people who aren't lawyers, people who don't have the means to go to law school, don't have the time, but care deeply about the types of cases that move through civil court, like eviction, like family court, all of that. People can go to a paralegal program in a couple of years and they can be taking those cases. So we'll open up the employment pool to people like me. I would love to be able to defend tenants, right? But I don't have time to go to law school. I'm fighting too many other fights. But I would be able to, in just a couple of years, be able to work on people's cases and fight for them in court. And that's really exciting to me. So we've got enough money to pay for enough lawyers and they can be spread out in our community. And we've also created a immediate rental assistance. And so if you need, you know, a small amount of money to start that stipulated agreement in good faith, you can apply to have that first payment paid. And so we've created an ecosystem of protections around the eviction process. And so we're really thinking, how do we keep people housed? It's not about winning or losing. It's about how do we prevent people from getting evicted? How do we prevent people from being houseless? And so cases go down, displacements go down. And then when people do move, they get longer and they avoid having that eviction on their record, which means in the future, they won't have to fight to be rehoused. It's one of the hardest things to come back from, having an eviction on your record. And so if you can move through the process without having it on your record, you are creating housing stability for yourself into the future. And so lawyers help with all of those things.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Colleen Carroll, who's an organizer with the Eviction Representation for All campaign. They're now getting signatures for the petition. They really want you to look for their petitioners and become a petitioner. We'll talk about that later. Colleen, one big issue has to be discussed. In eviction proceedings, the tenant has to get a lawyer. But after that, the lawyer does most of the thinking, makes most of the decisions. They're probably giving the tenant some options that they have to think about depending on the facts of the case. And sometimes the best you can do is, of course, bargain, as we discussed. It seems to me that giving tenants that power and making landlords think twice before they evict people, that's a matter of also, it greatly increases the power of that whole class of people, way over 50% of America who live precariously and spend more than 30% of their income on housing. And many go up to 50 or 60% of their income, especially if they have a large family and they have to throw a lot of people into the workforce. At least they can be housed. It seems to me that we also have to think about, I mean, one reason that so many people are homeless or moving in with a relative and worrying about how long they're going to be able to do that, it seems to me that the great problem that 60% of the people who are precarious face, lawyers can help them avoid eviction. But for the class of people, for all of those people, the problem with housing is that first, wages are going down for most working people. They're skyrocketing, these real wages, and purchasing power is going down for most people, while the upper 30% are doing well, and the upper 10% are doing fabulously, and the upper 1% are billionaires and billionaires and more billionaires. The problem they have is, one of the problems is low wages. Another one is they don't have medical care either, and they're not paying the utility bills. They need higher wages. It seems to me that's part of it. Another thing is, of course, that they need affordable housing. We don't have enough housing. Builders are not building housing. The federal government is had a housing program where they built housing for a very long time, and the voucher Section 8 housing does not get sufficient money to serve anything but a very small percent of that population. It seems to me that getting representation is really great, but that for the class itself, from all of those people, and for those of us who are concerned about homelessness and suffering and all of the rest and losing their friends, it seems to me what's necessary is a social movement from below that wins Medicare for all, that wins child care. Often people cannot enter the workforce, family members, because child care is extremely expensive. Sometimes people's wages don't keep up with the child care expense, especially if there are two kids. Anyway, I want to put on a plug for the necessity of getting really involved in movements and making sure that your neighbors and friends sign this petition, but also get active with your neighbors and friends and family in any one of the movements for shifting, redistributing income, and getting affordable housing.
Sure. I love that. I got into this campaign as a tenant organizer, as somebody who's really interested in building tenant power. I see, you know, our homes as the places where we should be organizing the way that we think about organizing in our workplaces. I've been reading and following up with Jane McAlevey's work, Organizing for Power, and she talks so well about structure, right? Like, you have to have a structure around which our organizing happens, and we build our campaigns, and it's, you know, not necessarily just an issue, right? And what is more of a structure that we all are connected to than our homes, right? And so as a tenant organizer and somebody who during the pandemic was going out having a lot of conversations, right? There was questions of rent strike. There was questions of cancel the rent. There was this movement, again, talking about what housing justice really looked like. And over and over and over again, we knew that the threat that all of our landlords had over us was that we were evictable. And we watched landlords evict tenants, even under what was called the, you know, the highest moratorium. We were told we were safe. We were told stay home. And those courts were open and they were evicting tenants. And they were evicting them because they had too many potted plants on their balconies. The TV was too loud. Your screen was missing. And these tenants would say, "Judge, I'm broke. I've been out of work since the start of the pandemic. I haven't been able to pay my rent in 4 months." And the lawyer for the landlord would say, "I object. That's not what we're here for. This is a for-cause eviction, not a non-payment case," because non-payment cases were the only ones that weren't allowed to be filed. And so that case would move through, even though the tenant, the lawyer, and the judge, and me as an observer knew that that tenant was being evicted because he hadn't paid his rent. And so everybody was still scared. We were told we were protected, and we weren't. And so when I started organizing, everybody said, how do I stay safe? And what I can't say to every tenant is that I'm going to keep you safe no matter what. But what I can say is, if you've got a lawyer by your side, the threat alone of eviction is less dangerous. It's less dangerous to you, it's less dangerous to me, and it's less dangerous even still if we collectivize, if we build a tenants association in our building, and then we find out what are the other buildings that our landlord owns, and we build a tenants union, and we build power that way. We absolutely have to be organizing in our buildings around the issues that you were talking about, right, about our wages and about access to healthcare. We need to be organizing about the surveillance that our landlords are doing on us and the state is doing. We need to be organizing with our neighbors in the same way that we organize in our workplaces as in a union, not around a single issue, but about the fact that we share some of the material conditions and we're going to fight for the improvement of those material conditions, not just the idea of a better living world, but we're going to build campaigns and we're going to organize neighbor to neighbor, block to block. And this gets us a little bit safer to do that work.
Colleen, it's been really good talking to you. I hope a lot of people out there want to become petitioners and work to make sure that it gets on the ballot. How can they get involved?
We've got a website, which is ERATenants, TENANTS.org, ERATenants.org. We've also are on all of the social media. On our website, there are two buttons you can push. One is sign the petition, and you can print out a single sheet, which you can fill out and sign and turn in. These have to be signed with a pen. They can't be signed online. So you got to get to a printer. So you can print your own sheet, or you can gather signatures. That's the other button. You hit gather signatures, and that'll print out a sheet that has a spot for 10 signatures. Print out one of those and find 10 people to sign and say, let's get this on the ballot. Let's get it in front of voters and see what the voters have to say. And after you've done 10, you'll realize that was pretty easy. Let me go get 10 more. Because as we've said before, this helps more than, 50% of us. We're renters. This is a renter's town. So get your first 10 in. And then if you're really interested, please email us, contact us on the website. We're a volunteer-led, tenant-centered campaign. We'd love to have you. We've got, field work, outreach, comms, fundraising. It's a really great place to come and learn how to build power through some of this electoral work, but also what comes next. And so we look forward to seeing you at some organizing meetings and out in the street. Look for us. We're in yellow shirts, often at your farmer's market, around town. Yellow shirts, yellow hat, ERA, eviction representation for all.
Colleen Carroll, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill.
That's RJD2 and Big Game following Bill Resnick talking with Colleen Carroll of the Eviction Representation for All Committee. Up next, Fran Mikkel tells us COVID is a social justice issue and you should be wearing a mask at activist events, even outside. Here's Fran Mikkel with more for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Wear a mask, wear a mask. Is this really much to ask? Tie some fabric round your face. Oh, it's the simplest of tasks.
People, folks, comrades, I'm here to explain why everyone at protests or other actions, even outdoors, should be wearing a high filtration respirator. That is, an N95 or K94 or KN95 or P100 or elastomeric with high quality filters. I'll call them masks for simplicity, although it's no longer really enough to tie a piece of fabric around your face. That's better than nothing, but we're beyond the era when a cloth or surgical mask was the best we could manage because of short supply. The CDC website will direct you to sources for free N95 respirators in your area, although you'll need to call those locations to find out what they have in stock. In Portland, you can also contact the folks at MaskBlock PDX. Their Twitter page has a link where you can ask for the kind of mask you need, and arrange for contactless pickup. But because no mask is perfect, and because the SARS-2 virus that causes COVID is rapidly evolving ever more transmissible variants, we are not beyond the era when your mask protects me and my mask protects you. I know, we are tired of the age of pandemics. I know that in summer that mask gets really hot and uncomfortable, but we are not beyond the SARS-2 pandemic, and it's worse than official statements suggest. Because of lack of testing or lack of reports of testing, we're undercounting cases. Indeed, one recent study suggested U.S. cases may be 30 times higher than official numbers. Because of narrowed categorizations of what counts as being hospitalized for COVID, only those receiving certain treatments, or what counts as dying from COVID, only a limited number of weeks after a positive test, we're also likely undercounting hospitalizations and deaths. Because of attempts to encourage everyone to get vaccinated and back to work and back to the office and back to spending more, the messaging from official and establishment sources has been minimizing the dangers. But this is not necessarily a mild disease. It is not the flu or a cold. It's true that those who are vaccinated and boosted are less likely to suffer the most acute cases, and so getting all possible vaccines and boosters remains an important precaution. But it's also true that in February, for instance, 40% of those who died were vaccinated and 15% of those who died were boosted. And vaccines do not prevent the transmission of cases, which allows the virus to spread and reproduce and evolve and develop new variants. So that having had COVID once does not mean you won't get it again, and repeated cases carry additional risks. Recent variants are more infectious. Where the original strain had an R0 of 3, meaning each person with the infection passed it on to about 3 others, the B4 and B5 variants now on the rise have an R0 of 18. Although in the past, we've mostly been able to have unmasked outdoor events that do not turn into super spreader events, new variants mean that even outdoors we should be taking precautions. These new variants are not only more contagious, but may also be more severe. And keep in mind that even mild COVID is linked to brain damage, and post-COVID problems include cardiovascular, kidney, and other health impairments, including an increased rate of death from heart attack and stroke in the year following having had COVID. Even asymptomatic cases can lead to long COVID, which even the CDC estimates affects about 20% of those who get the disease. As with many other viruses, including SARS-1 and HIV and Epstein-Barr, the effects of infection can unfold not just over days or weeks, but over months or years of illness and early death. Some have suggested that because of its capacity to damage the immune system, COVID can accurately be described as airborne HIV. Of course, the risks are greater for those with pre-existing comorbidities, a category which, even at the start of the pandemic, according to the CDC, included 60% of the U.S. population. 60. It's worse for those with suppressed or impaired immune systems, including those suffering from the stresses of injustice or who are older or people who are more exposed to the virus because of their essential work. This means that the ill effects have also had greater impacts in racialized communities. So caution about COVID is a matter of social justice, including racial justice and disability justice. So do you care about racial justice and disability justice? Do you care about at least looking as though you care about racial and disability justice? Do you care about making events welcoming to all your allies and potential allies, including people who are old or pregnant or who have disabilities or comorbidities or compromised immune systems or loved ones who are old or pregnant or immune compromised or immune suppressed? Do you believe that all our struggles are connected, that we are all connected, that we need to try to be the change we want to see in the world? Do you care about resisting the failure of the United States' so-called public health system? Do you care about maybe being a little less recognizable on facial recognition systems in the photos and videos the police are recording at the protest? Do you care about you and your allies and accomplices being as strong and sharp as possible for the long struggle ahead? Do you care about the lives and health and well-being of your family and friends and communities? Do you care about your own life and health? Yes to any of those? Then you should be wearing a mask whenever you're near other people. Yes, even outside. Yes, even if you're vaccinated. Yes, even if you've already had COVID and it was mild. Let's do all we can to be here for each other for the long struggle. Wear a mask.
We've got a lot to do, and it's not just the flu, so wear a mask.
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 Get your head.
That was Noah Lindquist and Ashley Young performing Wear a Mask here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, part of Fran Mikkel's segment on wearing a mask at activist events. On August 2nd, Kansans will vote on a constitutional amendment that opens the door to laws banning abortion. Up next, Joanna Brenner speaks with Ashley All, spokesperson for Kansans for Constitutional Freedom, a group organized to defeat this amendment. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, here's Joanna Brenner.
At this moment, the state of Kansas is ground zero for state-level election fights to defend legal abortion. With me today is Ashley All, spokesperson for Kansans for Constitutional Freedom. This is the coalition that is leading the battle to defend legal abortion in Kansas. Ashley All, welcome to KPOO.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Kansans for Constitutional Freedom is organizing to defeat Ballot Measure 2. Tell us about the ballot measure and the history behind it.
The constitutional amendment that is on the ballot on August 2nd would remove the current constitutional right to access abortion in Kansas and give politicians the power to pass any law they want regarding abortion, including a total ban. We are opposing this amendment and working to protect Kansans' constitutional rights and freedom to make decisions, private medical decisions, for themselves and their families, free from government interference. Abortion in Kansas is already heavily regulated, and this amendment is unnecessary.
I understand that in 2019, the Kansas Supreme Court found that there was a constitutional right to abortion in the current Kansas Constitution. Is that the reason that now the legislature has put this on the ballot?
Correct. In a case that they were looking at, they found a kind of broad right to personal autonomy. Kansans have a right to make decisions about their body, about their health care, life, future, work, etc. And within that, they found that Kansas women had the right to make decisions about pregnancy and about abortion care if they so choose, and thus have a constitutional right to access abortion. That is not an unlimited right. It is absolutely limited. There are restrictions and regulations in place. But yes, a limited right to abortion is in place. And after that decision, the legislature moved quickly to try to remove that right and put this amendment on the ballot.
Some people have said, I've read, that the ballot measure has been very confusing to voters because the name is something like Value Them Both, as if the constitutional amendment that they're proposing somehow includes women. How have you countered that in your organizing and your messaging?
There has been a lot of confusion about what this constitutional amendment does and what it doesn't do, and also what the law is and what it isn't in Kansas. And so we have worked very hard to make it clear that this amendment gives politicians the power to pass any law they want, including a total ban. They can regulate in situations of rape, incest, the life of the mother as well. That is something that is unclear. As you mentioned, the name of the amendment alone is called Value Them Both, but there are also other confusing words and language in the amendment, such as it mentions rape, incest, and the life of the mother, which could lead some voters to believe that those things are protected, but they are not. They absolutely can ban it in those situations as well. What is also included in the language is a reference to government funding of abortion. Government funding of abortion is already banned in Kansas. It's already outlawed, so it is really unnecessary language, but I think added to the amendment to make folks believe that that is something that is at risk. So yeah,
right.
It has been a pretty difficult amendment to explain to voters. And the other thing that I think is even more complicated is just the current state of the law, which the folks who are supporting this amendment have been fairly misleading about what the law currently is. They like to tell folks that it's not regulated at all. Abortion is not regulated in Kansas, but that is absolutely false. It is heavily regulated. It's banned
right.
after 22 weeks. Government funding of abortion is already outlawed. And there are numerous other restrictions, regulations, and safety regulations in place, including parental consent, mandatory waiting periods, mandatory ultrasounds, mandatory information that's provided to patients. And that doesn't even include all of the regulations and restrictions and requirements that are placed on clinics just because they are health facilities that are regulated by the state as well. So those are kind of the two big areas of misinformation that we have been trying to combat through our work. And some of that is through communication on television and digital, But a lot of it is also, we've been doing quite a lot of phone banking and canvassing around the state, trying to help voters understand exactly what's at stake here.
Yeah. I wonder if also one of the challenges that you faced was that in addition to the misleading character of the proponent's representation of this constitutional amendment, that they put it on a primary election in the middle of the summer.
Correct.
I wonder if it was difficult to get people, to encourage people on our side to register and to understand. And there must have been a registration deadline at some point, too.
Yes, that was an extra obstacle for us. There obviously have many things stacked against us, but we're still working hard and cautiously optimistic. But it was absolutely a challenge. In Kansas, the deadline to vote in the voter registration deadline to vote in this primary was July 12th. And we did push as hard as we could to get folks to register. And in fact, there was quite a large increase in voter registration in Kansas prior to that, which is encouraging. Obviously, that is not all probably one side, mm-hmm. but it is encouraging. You know, in Kansas, roughly 44% of registered voters are Republican, 26% Democrat, and then there is a big group of unaffiliated voters that make up about 29% of the electorate, and they're registered to vote, but they do not affiliate with a party, and so they do not vote in partisan primaries, which is what this typically is in August. This is highly unusual to have a constitutional amendment that takes away the rights of Kansans on a primary ballot instead of a general election mm-hmm. ballot, but we are doing our best to make sure folks understand that they can and should vote on August 2nd. And so this comes down to whether those unaffiliated Kansans show up and whether all the registered voters on either side show up. So we'll see. We'll continue to push. Some of that is also, we're doing that through phone banking and text banking and canvassing as well, just making sure people show up on or before August 2nd.
Yeah, I read in one place that voter turnout is actually forecasted to be fairly high, unusually high for a primary. So it looks like maybe both sides are motivating their voters?
Yeah, I do think that people are motivated. The decision at the end of June to overturn Roe, I think, was a wake-up call for a lot of Kansans, a lot of Americans, quite frankly, but a lot of Kansans, folks who weren't necessarily very engaged, but when that decision happened, they realized that they no longer had protection at the federal level for their rights. Mm-hmm. And so we really did see a surge in volunteer engagement and Kansans who want to be active and help in their communities. And that has been encouraging. I think it's still going to be an uphill battle, but we are definitely encouraged by the amount of energy that we've seen just in the last couple weeks.
Yeah, when you talk about new voters and people getting newly energized, can you give us a sense of who they are? Do they tend to be younger or do they tend to be women?
You know, I mean, I'm not sure exactly. We haven't got data on the new registered voters. We're working through that right now.
Right.
But what I can say
is
that,
your volunteers?
You know,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, no,
Sorry.
We've definitely seen, it's actually been kind of across the board increase. There's obviously interest from some of the usual suspects, people who are engaged on this issue all the time. They continue to be kind of the core volunteer group. But we've seen a really exciting and interesting expansion of younger activists, but also older women who are really upset and frustrated that something that they believe, I think they already had fought for,
yeah.
is now in question. And so, you know, I had a really lovely conversation with an older woman in Wichita who told me a story about her grandmother who had died from an illegal abortion and how it had kind of destroyed their family. And she was out canvassing in 95 degree heat, working very hard on behalf of her family. She was doing it, you know, in memory of her grandmother. So we have a really inspiring mix of age groups, of political leanings, you know, across the political spectrum, not just what we would consider young progressives. We have older progressives, we have older moderates, we have older conservatives, and even, you know, libertarians who just don't believe that government ought to be in your business.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Johanna Brenner here speaking with Ashley All, who is spokesperson for Kansans for Constitutional Freedom. That's a coalition organizing to defeat a proposed state constitutional amendment that would end constitutional protection of abortion rights in Kansas. We've talked about some of the challenges that the pro-choice side is facing and some of the ways in which voters have been energized and are coming forward to volunteer to help this effort. Ashley Aul, can you talk about what are some of your main messages to voters, and do you have different messages directed to different constituencies? Or
we really don't. One of the things that we've based our message on was the language of the Kansas Supreme Court ruling back in 2019, which gave Kansans the right to personal autonomy, personal liberty, the ability to make decisions about their body, about their health care for themselves and their families, free from government interference. That has resonated not just with progressive voters who are engaged on this issue, but across the political spectrum. Most Kansans, I would probably say most Americans, believe that some of these decisions about pregnancy and whether or not to continue a pregnancy or whether to get an abortion ought to be made by a woman, her doctor, and her support system, whoever that may be. And so we've really focused on that, and that is something that across the board resonates with Kansans, and I think probably resonates with a lot of Americans. I think that that is something that we've found has worked, and really a lot of Kansans are kind of in the middle on this issue. In politics, I think people like to divide us up into two groups and push us to different polar opposite sides, but that's not necessarily the way a lot of people think about certain issues. And I would say this particular issue is incredibly personal, incredibly private, incredibly complicated for a lot of people. And so we really do try to make it about personal choice.
I think that's very interesting that the core message that you have. I'm wondering, too, if there are other ways in which this issue resonates, I guess, across other issues that women are facing. One of the feelings I think many of us have is that abortion is the kind of tip of a wedge that's part of a much broader Christian, religious right, ethno-nationalist, white supremacist movement. And I wonder how you see this struggle in that context, the fact that whether you win or lose, it's going to be a close race. And is it in some ways a commentary or a response to that broader agenda?
What I have found probably the most inspiring in this campaign, and I have worked in politics in Kansas for a long time on candidate politics mostly, but I have been really inspired by the coalition of voters who have really got engaged with our campaign. And it is not just one type of person. They're a broad group of some people more libertarian, more conservative, some more progressive, but also even amongst our supporters, we have a lot of clergy and of different denominations, folks who work with different groups and communities all across the state. I think what is important to remember is that a lot of Kansans, a lot of Americans are in the middle on this issue and many other issues. And really what the way we start to bring back access in states like Kansas that tend to be considered more conservative and just in other states is by having conversations with people who may not completely agree with you, but finding common ground and realizing that we are far closer together than I think we typically think when we look at politics in this country. I think politicians tend to want people to be on their very clear partisan side, but I don't think that that is actually where the vast majority of Kansans or Americans fall. They fall somewhere in the middle. And so really, if I've learned anything during this campaign, it is to bring more people, broader groups to the table and have conversations about what common ground you can find on issues. Because while somebody might not agree with you on everything, they probably agree with you on the important things. And that is how we start to build back access and protect rights for people in this environment, I think.
You know, it's an interesting point. One of the facts of most of the abortion restrictions that were passed prior to ending Roe were aimed at making abortion care difficult to access and under the guise of protecting women or protecting health or so forth. And I wonder if that's something that you found in talking to people that the idea that these laws or restrictions are particularly harmful to people who have fewer resources and less access to funding and the kinds of support you would need to access a difficult, when abortion care is difficult to access.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely true. These laws disproportionately harm poorer women, people who have fewer resources to seek health care in the first place. That's why all the stories, the heartbreaking stories we've seen in the news since the decision in June, just amplifies that and just puts this larger spotlight on that. You know, women who have had health care delayed or their lives put at risk because the laws are now incredibly vague and complicated, and lawyers are making the decision about healthcare instead of doctors, which is a recipe for problems. You know, not only that, we've seen heartbreaking stories of young children who have had to, after being victimized, have been further victimized by being forced to travel distances to get care. You know, those stories are going to continue, and that is not the kind of place I think the vast majority of Americans and Kansans want to live in. That's not where we are. That does not follow our values. We understand that there are situations where abortion is necessary and important, health care, and I think we'll see access be restored if we can come together and find common ground. And most people agree on those certain situations as being critical for women.
Well, actually, all that is a very hopeful note to end on. And we certainly wish you the best of luck, and we'll all be pulling for you on the vote on August 2nd. And we've been talking with Ashley All from Kansas for Constitutional Freedom, who are fighting against a ballot measure that would essentially make abortion illegal in Kansas. Ashley All, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking about abortion, it's against the law, but we know that it's our right. Control of our bodies, we are going to win. We've got to be together to fight. Tell us to get married and have three or four kids, change the diapers, be a good wife. But we will decide how many children to bear. We've got to control our own lives. Free our sisters. Abortion is all right. Free our sisters. Abortion is all right. About abortion, gonna change the law and make a better way. Those men with the power got to bend or break. They've got some heavy dues to pay. Free your sisters. Abortion is all right. Free your sisters. Abortion is all right.
That was the New Haven Women's Liberation Rock Band singing Abortion Song, following Joanna Brenner and Ashley All for the Old Mole Variety Hour. And finally, this episode, here's Larry Bolden reviewing Monsi Shaw's 2021 novel, The Taste of Ginger, on the Old Mull Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I'm reading today a review by book mull Larry Bolden. Preeti Desai is a successful corporate lawyer who has, in her estimation, finally achieved the assimilation into American culture that she had striven all of her life to achieve. But then a horrible accident involving her brother and sister-in-law call her back to India, and she realizes how much she still walks like an elephant. Her mother has told her this so often. Quote, I was around 9 years old when I realized she wasn't calling me fat. She meant that I wasn't demure and obedient, qualities that every good Indian daughter should have. End quote. And so begins this fascinating, sometimes heartbreaking story of an Indian family that has immigrated to the U.S. and parents who desperately want their two children to assimilate and succeed as Americans, but also want them to retain Indian values and culture. Monsi Shaw, with her incisive and lovely prose, lays out this story in her 2021 novel, A Taste of Ginger. Preeti has not talked to her mother for months. Quote, not since she found out that my boyfriend, now ex-boyfriend, and I had been living together in Los Angeles, cohabiting with a Doria was, in her opinion, the most shameful thing her daughter could have done. Living with a white boy was right up there with marrying someone from a lower caste or talking back to your elders. End quote. Preeti and her brother Neil have been striving since childhood to slough off Indian clothes and habits in order to succeed in this new home in Chicago. Quote, despite living in America for over 20 years, my parents didn't have any friends who weren't Gujarati, much to my chagrin as a teenager trying to fit into this new country. Devon Avenue gave my parents the option of living in the West without giving up the East and expecting their children to do the same. End quote. When her brother and pregnant sister-in-law are seriously injured in a rickshaw truck accident in India, Preeti must fly, quote-unquote, home, although she risks losing her job at the law firm where she works 60-plus hours a week. And there she finds that as an NRI, or non-resident Indian, she is as singled out and as foreign as she has been in the United States. Unlike in Los Angeles, in India she looks the same as those around her, but is immediately set apart. Having been born in a higher caste, her family had lived a relatively wealthy life in India, with servants to care for their daily needs. In America, her engineer father is not recognized for the educated man he is and must take on what for him is menial labor. It is not until she returns to India that she really realizes how much her parents had given up to come to America. Neither had she really understood the Indian caste system, which she is forced to recognize when she has the audacity to associate with an Indian photographer who is of a lower caste. And finally, she did not realize that her mother had been unhappy in this country, yearning for her old life in India, but unwilling to go back. Quote, as an immigrant child of immigrant parents, I grew up knowing my future had to be their future. That meant getting the best grades, going to the best college, and getting the best job to ensure the sacrifices they had made for us were validated. End quote. While her brother Neil has also had to work hard to assimilate, he has been able to retain some core Indian values. He marries a very traditional Indian woman who seems to easily balance the two cultures. Preeti admires but also resents their apparent ease in reverting to Indian values. You guys, Preeti says to them, are among the lucky few that have a love marriage that fell within the biodata matches of the arranged system, and you have to protect it. You have to give me hope that someday, somewhere, I will be able to find that kind of happiness too. End quote. Although her sister-in-law survives the accident, The baby does not. And it turns out that Preeti must stay in India much longer than intended to help her beloved brother reunite with his grief-stricken wife. Shaw develops her story and her characters slowly with a keen eye and forgiving heart. Over the time there, Preeti finally manages to reconnect with her mother and to realize how she has struggled in her American life. She also comes to understand how limited her knowledge of the caste system is. Quote, "During my Indian childhood and infrequent trips back, I had never had occasion to be around anyone from another caste outside of servants and vendors, and I wasn't familiar with the differences in lifestyle between them. It hadn't occurred to me that there were public schools here, because I'd only known people who went to private ones. What I knew of India applied only to the upper caste, and I realized I knew nothing of how most of the country lived." End quote. This is a really lovely and insightful novel. Eventually, Preeti concludes that even arranged marriages have their advantages. I have been talking about Mansi Shah's novel, The Taste of Ginger. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kullberg, reading today for Larry.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for August 1st, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg and Larry Bolden, as well as Joanna Brenner, Fran Mikkel, and Bill Resnick. And also to their guests, Colleen Carroll and Ashley All. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.